Welcome to Hot Yoga Radio. What I'm going to do today is give a brief outline of Patanjali's remarks on pranayama, as found in the second chapter of the Yoga Sutra. Now, pranayama is the fourth limb of the eight limbs of the Ashtanga Yoga that Patanjali outlines in chapters 2 and chapters 3 of the Yoga Sutra. I think there's only three aphorisms on the matter. And the first one just gives it a sort of a bold definition of one approach to pranayama. And it seems that that approach is the same approach that's taken up in the Hatha Yoga Pradipika 1500 years later. So this is evidence that manipulation of the breath has got a very long and venerable history for changing consciousness or expanding consciousness. And in this first mention, pranayama, Patanjali says something like control or regulation of the duration of inhalation, exhalation, and the gap between inhalation and exhalation is pranayama. That's what he gives as a working definition of a type of pranayama. Also, in this aphorism, you are given the opportunity to actually ponder the word pranayama itself. Now, Patanjali doesn't do this, he doesn't unpick it for us, but if we look at the roots of the word, it gives a bit of purchase on it. Prana is thought to be vital energy or life force, some people translate it as, or vital force, vital energy. And the idea here is that there is a force, i.e. something that's kind of not visible in the material sense, like a tree is visible or so on, but which is a vitality that suffuses the entire universe and particularly that sort of concentrates in organisms. So and this is a view that's part of a very ancient ontology, cosmology, and it's actually found throughout the ancient world and actually has persisted in spite of scientific and technological developments up until quite late, and obviously amongst yogis and so forth it still so persists. But it's certainly an idea that the Greeks entertained of the 5th, 6th century and so on, and earlier. And it was certainly an idea that was entertained by Taoists in China, particularly by the sort of yogic practitioners within that cultural nexus. So it's kind of a primordial notion that there's a life force permeates everything. I think that this idea arose, just as a little aside, out of experiences. Of feeling the life or the life energy in the body, or what you take to be the life energy. This is about experiencing sensations of vitality and movement within the organism that are just most easily interpreted in terms of life force energy, that which animates, which is kind of immaterial, but which animates and gives us life. So that's the word prana in pranayama. And it's thought that breath, that the rhythm of breath is one of the obvious manifestations in the human organism, and actually in many animal organisms, of prana. So breath's a form of prana. Maybe it's a fairly kind of crude form of it, but no, it's a form of prana. So the next part of the word, we've got yama. Yama is a word which we've already encountered, probably, if we've read the Yoga Sutra, because that's the first limb of the eight limbs of the Ashtanga Yoga. And yama really is a good translation, actually. It's just discipline. So we've got this notion of breath discipline. And of course, this is what Patanjali has just outlined. It's the breath discipline that we find elaborated and given in a number of various articulations in the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, and in fact the Hatha Yoga text in general. And this literally is manipulation of the breath. Breathing in for a certain period of time to a certain depth, holding the breath for a certain period of time, exhaling the breath for another period of time, producing ratios of inhale, hold, exhale, maybe hold in the breath after the exhale, etc. And a whole lot of different patterns can be imposed on the breath, producing obviously psychological effects. And I'm sure we're all familiar with the fact that bellows style breathing, or fast emphatic breathing can produce hyperventilation, which can in some circumstances produce quite psychedelic effects. And it's noteworthy here that when the eminent psychiatrist Stanislav Grof emigrated from Czechoslovakia to America, he had to drop 17 years of research with LSD in a therapeutic setting as a therapeutic modality because of the making illegal of LSD and the aggression against its use by the American state. So Grof had to, wanted to carry on with his therapeutic work, had to kind of cast around for some other way of getting into these psychedelic states, and he came up with holotropic breathwork, which is not dissimilar from the Hatha Yoga Pranayama's Bhastrika and Kapalabhati, these kind of things. So we know it can affect physiology, we know it can affect consciousness by affecting brain chemistry. And this is what Patanjali is talking about in that aphorism. Oh, I should mention the pranayama, yama, breath discipline, but we've also got prana, ayama. So there's a certain ambiguity built into the word. And ayama gives us a sense of, I think, of increase or intensification. So it's like pranayama is breath discipline with an interest in increasing the amount of prana in the body, in the individual human being. More energy, more vital energy. So that's the first aphorism. Then immediately following that, Patanjali says something like, well, there is a fourth pranayama, and this is the really, really juicy one. And why the fourth? Well, actually that previous aphorism deals with inhale, one pranayama, hold, two pranayama, exhale, three pranayama, three things that you do with the breath in a disciplined way. So there's a fourth, and Patanjali is kind of hinting really what's going on here. It's kind of, if you look at the translations that people offer, they vary a great deal at this point. Now, what I think is going on there is that in the aphorism, Patanjali states that there's some kind of transcendence of the inner and the outer, by which I take it that he's referring to the in-breath and the out-breath. So there's a kind of a transcendence of this control, is really what he's saying here. You know, what he's talking about there is the pranayama of allowing the breath to settle into a frictionless and natural state. This is what the fourth is. And in this state, if one is very relaxed and sitting quietly in a quiet place conducive to contemplation, then the breath settles and it may even suspend, may even just pause, but quite naturally you're not holding the breath, it just stops because your body's not, doesn't have a great thirst for oxygen because you're being very still. And in fact the word that Patanjali uses that I've translated as transcend also can mean suspend, giving us this kind of hint at the suspension of the breath. A spontaneous kumbhak is how you might put this, you know. Kumbhak meaning, it's a word which means a pot, and it's used to refer to the holding of breath in hatha yoga pranayama, where the body's like a pot containing this kind of fluid of prana, or just holding air. So yeah, this fourth one, I call it actually a natural breath, naturally settled breath, a breath without friction and so on. And in this we're not manipulating the breath. Remember, hatha yoga is very keen on manipulation. Hatha means force. But if you've heard me talk about yoga and so on, it strikes me that actually there's an immense problem around the notion of force and overcoming everything with will, overcoming the human condition with will. It's not actually possible, you know, and it's a lot of people have a romance about that idea. I mean, what more desirable to a shivering little ego than being able to control everything? And I think that interpretations of Patanjali that take that line are just misguided, you know, and you can try it if you like, it won't help you. So the fourth is the settling of the breath. I mean, Patanjali when he describes hatha yoga pranayama, he doesn't say it gives any benefits or anything like that, other than the fact that it might increase prana, might give rise to, you know, intensified vital energy. But the one that he congratulates is the fourth. The fourth, as he goes on to say in the following aphorism, reveals or unveils the inner light, prakasha. And everybody's translated as inner light, and some of the pundits of course have to use a capital I and a capital L. You know, it's the mystic light. Again, which is mentioned and shrouded in mystery in mystical writings from across the ancient world and onwards right the way up into modern times. People are still talking about this stuff. Now I see two things going on there. The fourth pranayama, the settling of the breath into its natural and frictionless and completely easeful state, allows the inner light to come into the foreground. Well, this word prakasha, light, for light, I mean, pra means kind of forward, and kas means to shine, so it's kind of shining forward. So when one allows the breath to settle into a frictionless and beautiful and delicious easefulness, then shining forward happens. Well, what's going on here? And I think this is referring to the clarity of vision, the clarity of seeing. Remember, Patanjali is all about seeing, whether inwardly, into the microcosm, into our so-called inner territories, or outwardly, what we take to be the world. Patanjali's whole thing about yoga is that yoga is what happens when seeing is clear, and seeing is clear when there's not a load of internal noise raising the dust and obscuring the vision. And so we can kind of get there, according to Patanjali, just by simply allowing the breath to settle into its easeful and frictionless state. So that's what's going on there, I think. But also the word, you know, in inner light, I mean, this also refers to, I would say, to photic phenomena that occur when the mind isn't sort of busy with internal dialogue and discourse and argument and anxiety and the whole kind of clatter that the brain is capable of producing. When that kind of subsides or goes into the background somewhat, we do find very often that people experience photic phenomena. You see things, you see visions, you see coloured lights, you see white light. You maybe you see the lightning of Kundalini in the spine, etc. We open ourselves up to photic phenomena. And that's kind of, those things are fun, I have to say. And very stimulating to artists, and often fascinating the beautiful. I would just take it that one doesn't get too, I don't want to say attached. There's nothing wrong with attachment, to be honest with you. But one can get kind of beguiled by photic phenomena. And it's probably a good idea, if you can, to keep moving on, you know, just to say she's great, but what's next? And to take photic phenomena as a sign, and just as, well, okay, Patanjali mentioned this, and we see. But if we take Prakash as clarity of vision, which enables us to know and to see. I think you can see that this is another case of an entry point into the yoga being state. I have mentioned elsewhere that the Yoga Sutra has got this, as well as being a linear text, particularly the eight limbs, you know, and showing us a kind of linear stepwise approach to yoga being state. At the same time, it's also holographic, and that throughout the entire text we find these moments, little gateless gates into the yoga being state. And I think this is one. If the breath settles, the clarity comes. So I take it that's what's going on there. And of course the next limb is pratyahara, which is withdrawal of the senses. Well, it seems to me we've actually already done that. We've decided to let the breath settle. So we're paying inward attention straight away if we practice pranayama in this fourth style. But Patanjali mentions pratyahara, and it kind of reinforces that. And it's inward. Now the door has been opened for us to be with the yoga being state. What he says there, Patanjali says, now that the light has dawned, that we're ready for dharana, concentration, you know, and then. And to go through the last three limbs of the Yoga Sutra, they say your concentration, bringing the mind into focus, meditation, the mind keeps focus easily until it merges with an object of attention, an object of focus, an object of concentration, so that there is now no effort to keep self and object separate, subject and object. Become no longer distinct, and that is obviously useful because it actually takes energy to keep subject and object apart. So there's an easefulness dawned, which is samadhi, in which there is no distinction between subject and object, between self and world, between inner and outer, and between enlightenment and ignorance, as it so happens also. Anyway, as I say, this is a prolegomena to some future and more detailed work on the Yoga Sutra. If there's a call for it, if you're interested, ask me. Thank you. And goodbye from Heart Yoga Radio. Over and out.